Hello, I'm Jim Richards. I want to welcome you to the broadcast this week. You know, we're going to be talking about one of the most important topics that I know of, and it's healing the broken heart. And this is going to help you understand why you do a lot of dysfunctional things you do, why you repeat a lot of your same mistakes, but it's also going to help you understand how that you can get out of it. And don't forget, this month we're offering my book, We Still Kiss, as well as the 6-CD series, The Art of Staying in Love, along with about 10 bonus CDs that we're going to just throw in for free that I think is some of the best material on building relationships and staying in love that I've ever heard anywhere. You know, unless you know how to guard your heart, you probably won't really be able to stay in love. And I quote this scripture all the time. The Bible tells us that we have to guard our heart above everything else because out of it flows all of the issues of life. And that word issues could just as well have been translated as boundaries. Every boundary in my life, whether it's finances, whether it's happiness, whether it's health, or whether it's loving relationships, is the product of what I believe in my heart. And I know it's easy for you to say, well, what about what the other people do? Well, I understand other people bring something to this party, but the real truth is I get into the relationships I get into because of how I see myself. I get into it because of what I believe about myself, and it gets destroyed because of what I believe. Now, I understand that there's two people in this, but you can only deal with your part of it. You can't really deal with the other person. Now, listen, the heart is the seat of love. So and these are all biblical terminologies. If the heart is broken, if the heart is crooked, if the heart is covered in footprints, then try as we may, we probably will never be able to sustain a meaningful relationship. And all of those are terminologies that the Bible uses to describe what happens to our heart as we experience just day-to-day pain through life of you know, just what happens when we're growing up, what happens with our family, what happens in early relationships and all of those things. Now, the beliefs of the heart, more than anything else, are really what you believe about you. You see, when your heart is broken, yes, you've had hurts and you've had pains from the outside, but the real truth is the great devastation is really not the pains from the outside. The great devastation is what this causes you to believe about yourself and then ultimately what you believe about God. Now, once we believe something about ourselves, then our heart constantly and subtly, but very powerfully, moves us to make the decisions that support what we believe about ourselves. In other words, if I don't believe I deserve to be happy, then the truth is not only I will probably never find happiness, but when I do find happiness, I will destroy that happiness. You know, one of the greatest deals that things that I had to deal with growing up was the fact that I did not believe I was lovable. And these were beliefs that were established throughout my life because of what went on in my family, because of things that were said to me. And these beliefs, once they became a part of how I saw myself, played out in every single relationship that I ever tried to have as a teenager and as an adult. Many of you have heard me talk about how my father was emotionally and physically abusive to our family. You know, he tried to kill my mother. I woke up many nights to the sound of my father beating my mother and her begging for mercy and begging for her life. When we were children, he tried to burn the house down with all of us in it, and my mother fought him off and protected us. And then finally, of course, he abandoned us and left us destitute and would only come back from time to time and steal all the money and food that we had and take out and give to the other women that he lived with and his illegitimate children. And so we would be destitute. I can remember in the winters not having all my shoes were filled with holes and not having clothes, warm clothes to wear, and having no heat for our stove. You know, my brother and I would have to go down in the woods when we were really small kids and cut wood many times because we didn't have any other way to heat our house because our dad had stole all of our money, all of our food, everything that we had. Now, in the heart of a child, everything that happens in a household is about you. You think it's about you. And somehow it's because of you that these things happen. Now I'm talking about in the heart of a child. You know, children think, I should have been able to rescue my mother. or why doesn't my dad love us? Or why does he take our food? And why does he take our money? You know, I can remember I was in the hospital as a child, and people had given me some money. They'd give me little cards and have a little bit of money. And I was probably maybe 5 years old, and so I probably had $5. And that was a lot of money back in 1956. And I can remember my father coming home to visit. And he didn't come to see me when I was in the hospital, but he came home to visit. And while he was home, he found that money that people had given me, and he took it. And I know he just took it and drank it up. Boy, things like that were just devastating to me and to any child. Now, our family had an interesting dynamic, just like every family. My brother was my mother's pet, and she made a pretty obvious difference toward him, my sister and myself. In other words, he was always favored. My mother felt sorry for him for various reasons, but he was always favored. He always got by with things. And when it came down to it, if it was a choice between my brother being in trouble or me being in trouble, I would very often be the one get in trouble when it really wasn't my fault. Now, my sister was my grandmother's pet. And my grandmother, of course, made a monumental difference toward her. And really, I was the loner in the family until my uncle came home from the Air Force. And when my uncle came home from the Air Force, I lived with my grandmother at the time. He took me under his wing and really became the only man in my life that ever had any kind of positive, healthy, or godly influence whatsoever. But still, I was a loner, and I was a silent survivor. Now, I want you to understand, my mother did not mistreat me. She didn't mistreat my sister. She just favored my brother. Now, my sister really treated me like I was her baby. She tells me that she can remember when they brought me home from the hospital and how that right off the bat, you know, she began to take care of me and treat me like I was her own. But, you know, ultimately, she had to go to school, and all of that ended. And, you know, later on, her going off to school probably became an issue of abandonment for me, because abandonment became my ultimate life struggle. Now, my brother was brutal from childhood. I'm not trying to be critical of him. He got saved, and I thank God for it. But I'm telling you, as a child and as a young man, he was an incredibly brutal person. So I had to learn how to survive with someone that I constantly feared. And he was somebody else that if I ever had anything of value and he found out about it, he would steal it. And he would sell it or tear it up or throw it away or something. And so, like I said, I was a silent survivor. Now, being a survivor is a trait that really saved me emotionally and even physically when my stepfather came into the scene. But, you know, those things that we use to save ourselves or to survive with when we're young are the very things that destroy us when we get older. So as an adult, being a survivor really cost me most of my relationships and most of my friendships. After my dad left, my sister and my brother were both in school, I was sent to live with my grandmother. Now, my grandmother was emotionally unstable, and it really wasn't noticeable unless you were with her alone. My grandmother had been deeply wounded, and I really don't know how far back it went. I know that she married late in life. She was not an attractive woman, and who knows what she went through as a child growing up. But my grandfather, who was considerably older than her, just deeply loved my mother, and for some reason, that caused my grandmother to despise my mother. And so, even though she was kind to us and would help us with groceries and you know, let me live there with her while my brother and sister were in school, so she was generous in so many ways, still, when I would live with her during the week, her deep emotional pain and her terrible attitude toward my mom was really the perfect storm for her neurosis to play out in the life of a helpless child, and boy, did it ever. Now, as long as people were around, she was completely normal. But I'm telling you, when people left, it was on. She would play every kind of mind game that you could imagine. I remember one time I was a little child. Remember, I'm 4 years old, 5 years old when this stuff is happening. One time, I couldn't find her anywhere in the house, and I was looking for her. And there was a little rubber ball in the middle of the kitchen floor. And I saw it. I, you know, didn't think anything about it, but I looked for her until I started crying. I thought I was alone. I thought I'd been abandoned. And so eventually, she comes out. She had been hiding somewhere. So she sat down with me, And she said, "You couldn't find me, could you?" And I said, "No, couldn't find you." And she said, "When you went in the kitchen, did you see that little rubber ball on the floor?" And I said, yeah, I saw it." And she said, "Well, that was me." And she says, "Now I'm going to turn you into a rubber ball." Well, man, it scared the daylights out of me. So immediately I began crying again. Well, by this time, my face is all flushed. And she tells me, she said, "Go in the bathroom and look in the mirror. You're already turning red." So I go in the bathroom. My face is red. I'm thinking I'm being turned into a little rubber ball. And you know, I'm scared to death. And I don't remember now how I begged her into not continuing with this curse that she was putting on me. But it was just one mind game after another. And one of the most horrible parts of staying with her was that at night, just before bedtime, she'd always want to tell my fortune. She'd get out a deck of cards. She'd start going through these cards and she'd start going, "Uh-oh, this really looks bad." And I'm like, What do you mean it looks bad? What do you mean it looks bad?" And she'd turn another card. She'd say, "Oh, no, this is not going to be good. What do you mean?" And she would tell me, she would say, "Tonight, someone is going to break into your room and kill you." Now, I'm 4 years old. I'm 5 years old. Man, I'm telling you, I'm horrified. Then she would send me off to bed by myself. Then to add insult to injury, many times during the night, she'd go outside and scratch on the window as if it was someone trying to break inside the house to kill me. Man, oh man, oh man. She always told me these dark, fearful stories about the devil, and usually at night, and then usually would send me to bed alone. And you know, as a child, I lived in constant terror. I lived in constant pain. There was nobody I could get help from. I would tell some of these stories to adults. Nobody believed me. But you know, probably the worst terror that I can remember is after one of these nights when she told me that I was going to die in my sleep that night. I'm 4 or 5 years old. I go in this dark room alone and curl up in the middle of the bed, you know, because you're so afraid, and you're burying yourself under the cover because you're just trying to hide any way that you can. And sometime in the night, she slipped into the room and reached out from under the bed and grabbed me by the leg, and as if she was trying to pull me under the bed. Now, I didn't know it was her. I thought it was this person that was going to break into the room and kill me. You know, and she never told me the difference. I mean, I was nearly grown before I sorted out all of these things that she did to me, and that it was actually her doing these things. And like I say, when I would try to tell somebody, nobody believed it was really happening. But see, none of this is what did the greatest amount of emotional damage to me. See, she sought to convince me that my mother didn't love me and that ultimately that I was unlovable. So she told me bad things about my mother. Most of them were either untrue or extremely exaggerated. Some of them were true, and some of them were the typical failings of any, you know, kid growing up. But I'll never forget one of the most devastating experiences that I ever had with her, and that made a footprint on my heart. Where she took me outside one day, and we sat on the front porch, and it was a spring day, and as we sat outside, she broke out a Sears catalog, and she started turning through the pages where the men's suits were. And as we looked at these men's suits, she said, "I want you to look in here." She said, "You see these men in here?" I said, "Yes." She said, "You can order a daddy." Now, I'm telling you, that perked me up, because if there's anything I want it to have a daddy. I want it to have somebody there that, you know, like other kids had, that would play games with you, be there for you, talk to you, tell you stories, teach you how to fish, do things with you. And you know, it's amazing. I've told this story many times in congregations, and people would start laughing when I would tell this. And I guess maybe on some level it seems a little funny, but I'm telling you, the heartbreak that ensued as a result of this was tragic, and not only hurt me deeply, but played a role in me hurting many, many people very, very deeply. So I go through and I pick out what looks like would be a really good daddy, and she tells me that she's going to place the order. And, you know, day after day, like a little child, I'm like, "When is it coming? When is it coming?" Because, see, I was thinking I was going to surprise my mother, that she would come over there and that this wonderful man would be there that would father her children and be a husband to her and protect us from my abusive father. And so day after day, you know, I wanted to know where he was. Well, finally, one day, she takes me back out on that same place on the porch, and we sit down, and I'm wanting to know, when is he coming? When is he coming? When am I going to get a daddy? And she sat down and she said, well, he's not going to come. And I said, well, why isn't he going to come? You said he was going to come. And she said, basically, nobody wants to be your daddy. And suddenly all the years of rejection, all the things that my father did, all the abandonment that I'd gone through, suddenly culminated into one deeply painful, emotional stab in the heart where, yes, it seemed true that my father did the things he did because of me and because I was unlovable. You know, my dad finally left, and my stepfather, who came into the picture, was even more brutal than my dad. And, you know, there I was. I was sent away to live with this crazy woman. Nobody wanted me. And, you know, by the time I was 14 years old, the rejection and pain in my life was so bad. I ran away from home at 14. I went and lived with an uncle that I told you was so kind to me, and he let me stay with him. I finished out the school year. I went back home, and I wasn't home any time till I climbed out the window, hitchhiked back to where my uncle lived, enrolled in school, and went to school there the next year. And then went back home again, and my parents, my mom and stepdad, insisted I was going to have to stay home, and I ran away again. And, you know, when I look back on all of this, what I realize is that through all of these situations, these beliefs, primarily the belief that I was unlovable, led me into and through every kind of destructive relationship that you can imagine. You know, by the time I was 15 years old, I was living with an adult woman just so I'd have a house to live in, just so I didn't have to sleep in an abandoned car or in a cardboard box, which I'd done before, you know. Every kind of compromise that you can imagine in life, I was making. And, you know, I was constantly getting into relationships that had absolutely no chance of surviving. And if by some strange coincidence I managed to get into a relationship that actually started looking stable or started looking like something good could come out of it, something in me would click and I would cheat. And if I cheated, I did it in a way that I would deliberately get caught. I can remember time after time after time when I would be in a relationship with somebody, and I didn't understand what went off in my head. I didn't understand the switch that flipped inside me, but I would plan it out, and I didn't even know why. I would plan it out. I'd go out with somebody else, and I would make sure that I went somewhere so that I could get caught, so the relationship could blow up. Many times, I would just walk out. I would just absolutely disappear. You know, I've left houses, cars, furniture, possessions of all kinds, and leave without that other person even knowing where I was going or what I was going to do. I'm telling you, I would just disappear. It's all I knew how to do, because the relationships I would get into were either so dysfunctional that they couldn't make it, or if the moment they looked like they were going to make it, I would do something to absolutely destroy that relationship. Disappear, cheat, lie, be cruel, do every kind of thing that you can imagine just to drive somebody away from you. So, you know, for the first 30 years of my life, it really wouldn't have mattered who was in my life. It really wouldn't have mattered who I was in a relationship with. If it had been good, I would have found a way to destroy it. The truth is, I left a trail of broken hearts and broken people and wounded people behind me. But you see, what was happening in my life was the product of living with a broken heart. Now, I didn't get my heart healed all at once. In fact, I don't really think anybody gets their heart healed all at once. I think God can bring you relief. I think God can bring something into you that just by praying a prayer that you mean or getting somebody to pray with you. But as far as ultimately healing your heart, that's a journey that takes place. You know, I talk about how much Brenda's love for me affected me. And, you know, the thing about Brenda, I guess, Brenda and I got married, got involved with each other, and we did so many unhealthy and destructive things and getting together. But ultimately, Brenda was the only person that didn't come into my life because she could get something out of me. You know, I wasn't a rock star. I didn't have money. I was sick. I had a disease. I was dying. So for the first time, somebody came into my life that I didn't feel like was just trying to get something from me. But you know what? For all the value that that brought to me, and that was crucial in facilitating what needed to happen in my life, but the real truth is what Brenda brought into my life is not what really brought about my healing. My healing started when I discovered a verse that said, as much as it lies within you, live at peace with all men. Now, I was taught to take my stand. I was taught that if you're a believer, you take your stand on what's right. You know what? And I looked back through my life, and as a believer, taking my stand left a trail of broken bodies. I saw that the Bible says, talks about the way of peace, that this people in this generation, they didn't know the way of peace. I realized I didn't know the way of peace. I didn't have value for peace. I didn't understand what would happen. And when I made a commitment to live in peace, then I realized that the only way that could happen would be if I made a commitment to walk in love. You know, I made a decision about 30 years ago that every day in my life, I was going to live as much as I could to make people feel valuable, to make people feel and experience the love of God. And it's that journey that has changed my life. It's that journey that took me through the process of healing. And if you'll make the decision that you're going to love other people, if you'll make the decision that more than wanting to feel love, you want to give love away, then I promise you this, you'll discover the love of God and you'll start feeling the love from people around you. I'll be back in just a moment with our mentoring moment, and I'm going to talk to you about some really important steps you can take to begin to feel and experience the love of God. Welcome to our mentoring moment. You know, it's so important that you take away from this some essential things. The number one thing you want to realize is this. Your inability to receive love is based on, to some degree, your fear or unwillingness to give love. You see, usually we get the entire process backwards. And it's like, if I could just feel love, I would start giving love. Well, it just really doesn't work that way. You see, the grace of God, which is God's ability, God's strength, God's capacity to do what you cannot do in your own strength, that's what you need working inside you. And a phenomenal thing about grace is that anytime we seek the grace to give something away, automatically, we get that same grace makes us capable of receiving. It's just like in the area of financial prosperity. You know, people who seek the grace to be generous in return experience the grace to receive and to prosper. People who seek the grace, God's capacity, God's strength to give love away are the very people who start growing in their capacity to experience the love of God. So, if you make a decision to love people, it's one of the things that you want to do. You want to be sure and go to 1 Corinthians 13. You want to read God's attributes for love. And really, on a daily basis, you want to make sure that you are expressing love the way God says to express love, not the way the world says to do it, not the way some humanist philosophy says to do it. And, you know, you can make a list of those traits and just kind of daily, just like review them and pray over them. And you may realize people throughout the day that you have treated them in ways that are inconsistent with that. You know what you do? You apologize, you repent, you do whatever you got to do so that you always come back to walk in this track. And here's what will happen in your life. As you give people more love, you will suddenly not only start to experience a realization of God's love, but you will start to feel love from other people. You'll start to suddenly, any act of kindness that people show to you that would have previously gone unnoticed, I got news for you. You'll start feeling it. You'll start experiencing it. And you'll grow in love, and you'll grow in your expression of love.